to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Scott X. Esdale, member of the NAACP National Board of Directors, who examines the recent arrest of a Coast Guard lieutenant accused of plotting to assassinate Democratic Party leaders and media personalities to further his white supremacist ideology. Kim Ives, an editor with the Haiti Liberté newspaper, who talks about anti-government protests in Haiti linked with corruption charges surrounding funds embezzled or misspent from Venezuela's Petrocaribe oil discount program. And Roger Geller, Portland, Oregon's bicycle program manager, who discusses the advances his city has made in expanding bike ridership and the benefits for the community and environment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the early days of the Trump administration, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pushed a plan to build dozens of nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia in possible violation of the Atomic Energy Act, which requires congressional approval of nuclear exports. Flynn resigned and later pled guilty to lying to the FBI and cooperated with the Mueller investigation into his communications with Russian officials. Before joining the Trump administration, Flynn had worked with energy interests seeking to build nuclear power plants in the Persian Gulf. A report by the House Oversight and Reform Committee called for further investigation into a possible Saudi nuclear deal and conflicts of interest with the Trump family and close allies. Key players beyond Flynn included his deputy, Derek Harvey, and Tom Barrack, a top Trump fundraiser who raised $7 million from investors in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Details of the Saudi nuclear scheme were exposed in 2017 by ProPublica. One of the companies that would profit from a U.S.-Saudi nuclear deal would be Westinghouse Electric, now owned by Brookfield Asset Management, which bailed out a Manhattan building project owned by the Kushner family. Despite resistance from some national security officials, momentum is building for a Saudi nuclear deal. However, after the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi officials, Congress is reluctant to agree to a transfer of nuclear technology to the Saudi kingdom. Hedge fund investors won a round in the ongoing battle over Puerto Rico's massive debt. The American Prospect reports that a U.S. federal court approved a plan that locks in 40 years of extremely generous government payments on sales tax-backed bonds, the island's largest pool of debt. The deal will saddle the island with a regressive 11.5% sales tax, higher than any state in the U.S. Critics have long complained that the process to restructure Puerto Rico's debt only reinforces the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico's colonial status, giving power over the island's future to an unelected federal financial oversight board. Now a U.S. court has rubber-stamped the deal with no participation from Puerto Rico's residents. The restructuring plan for what is known as COFINA debt carries grave consequences for the vast majority of Puerto Ricans, money that could be funding health care, education, and a just recovery from 2017's hurricanes and a 13-year economic depression, will instead pad the pockets of hedge fund billionaires and their wealthy investors. Opposition to this unjust debt plan is growing, and with it, international solidarity is likely to grow too. California's newly sworn-in Governor Gavin Newsom promised a Marshall Plan for housing and in his proposed state budget asked that $1.75 billion be dedicated to alleviating the housing shortage. Housing advocates praised the new commitment, noting that former Governor Jerry Brown had failed to address the affordable housing crisis. Foundations and major tech companies are pledging to invest in new low-income housing in the Bay Area, where gentrification has decimated working-class communities. The Partnership for the Bay's Future plans over the next decade to build 8,000 low-income apartments and preserve 175,000 affordable housing units. California has an estimated shortage of 1.5 million units of affordable housing. More than 3 million tenants statewide spend more than one-third of their annual income on rent. Last fall's Proposition 10 would have allowed local governments to expand rent control. It was fiercely opposed by developers and private equity investors like Blackstone, which had purchased large numbers of foreclosed homes after the housing collapse a decade ago. In the aftermath of the defeat of Proposition 10, progressive housing activists are looking for new strategies to strengthen tenant rights. These activists are now looking to team up with unions to put pressure on private equity companies and institutions like universities and hospitals, which are often the drivers of gentrification and the destruction of affordable housing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
A U.S. Coast Guard lieutenant and self-identified white nationalist was arrested last week on weapons and drug charges related to a terrorist attack he had been plotting. The 49-year-old resident of Silver Spring, Maryland, is accused of stockpiling weapons and ammunition in order to carry out assassinations against a list of journalists and Democratic Party political leaders he had compiled. The man's ultimate goal, in his own words, was to establish a white homeland. Among those targeted for assassination were House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senators Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Richard Blumenthal, along with U.S. Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Maxine Waters, and former House member Beto O'Rourke. Also included on the terrorist hit list were MSNBC hosts Chris Hayes and Joe Scarborough, as well as Don Lemon and Van Jones from CNN. Your reporter spoke with Scott X. Estale, member of the NAACP National Board of Directors and president of the NAACP Connecticut State Conference. Here, Estale examines the arrest of the Coast Guard lieutenant plotting domestic terrorism and what he says is the urgent need for Congress to open hearings on the rise of white supremacist hate groups coinciding with the Trump campaign and presidency.
We've been seeing this backlash ever since President Obama's first run for presidency. Ever since he won that election, there's been a strong backlash to African Americans across the nation. It started pretty much with the Tea Party, and then that particular climate has escalated into Donald Trump winning in the White House after President Obama. Since he's been in office, he's really been throwing gas on the fire, striving to increase the tension nationwide. It's interesting with this particular arrest for this Coast Guard, who was actually a lieutenant. He was a high-ranking officer. Obviously insane in reference to striving to create a race war here in the United States, creating a beachhead for all whites in America. If the government does not take this serious, this will continue to increase. People will, get very, very upset and start getting into their own corners, and the tension will rise. And then, we're going to start seeing physical fights in the streets. And I think it's imperative that the leaders of government and our government officials should take this serious. But now what we're seeing is that the government is monitoring Black activists that are out here protesting, and the national NAACP at our headquarters is calling for hearings before the Homeland Security and also before the National Judiciary Committee to try to calm this stuff down going on around the country and get the government to work for the people and strive to stop this violence instead of pouring gasoline on it and enhancing this climate.
As you just said, the NAACP is calling for the House Judiciary Committee and the House Committee on Homeland Security to conduct hearings on domestic terrorism and the threats of white supremacist violent organizations. What can the Congress do? What can the federal government do to push back against these violent organizations that preach hate?
Well, it's their job to protect and serve. It's their job to arrest people and put people like this lieutenant away. If you keep being passive and letting this racism run rampant around America, bad things are going to happen, just like bad things have happened in the past. We found in the KKK years ago, it was high-ranking public officials that were part of these organizations. And that's why they had to wear hoods over their head, because at night they were terrorists and during the day they were public officials. Now we're seeing lieutenants, they're supposed to be guarding, protecting our nation, and they're actually trying to create the war in our nation. So it's very hypocritical. And we're asking the government, you know, to take this thing serious and lock these people up and put them away, because they know who these people are. They should know who they are, and they need to take it more serious instead of monitoring the people that are using their constitutional rights to protest and strive to call America on the bad things that are going on in reference to police officers killing unarmed people in America. They should be arresting these hate groups like the White Wolves and the neo-Nazis and the skinheads and the KKK that are rearing their ugly heads back as if they were still back in the mid-1800s and the early 1900s.
And the other part of the call that the NAACP has made, again, as you mentioned, the NAACP is calling for more transparency about government agencies that are using methods to track and monitor Black activists, like many tens of thousands of people who've rallied against police brutality and police violence under many banners, including the Black Lives Matter banner. Tell us a bit about what it is that Congress can do to expose some of these extra-constitutional surveillance programs that are targeting activists.
Well, they need to stop. That's what they need to do. The government needs to stop monitoring people that are exercising their constitutional rights. And they need to be putting away the bad guys, not the good guys. And that's the number one thing that the government needs to do. And they need to do it immediately, swiftly, and decisively, and stop playing games. We've learned about the counterintelligence program of the 60s and the 70s, and it seems like the government is still carrying out these same type of practices and tactics. And it's imperative that the government, meaning the Judiciary Committee, do a full-fledged investigation on this crisis, and also homeland security in reference to protecting us at home and making sure that we're safe at home and not being targeted and zeroed in on in reference to what this guy was doing. Once again, a high-ranking official was a lieutenant and striving to start a race war at the same time.
That was Scott X. Esdale, member of the NAACP National Board of Directors and president of the NAACP Connecticut State Conference. Find more commentary and analysis on the rise of racist hate groups across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thousands of anti-government protesters took to the streets across Haiti beginning February 7th, where clashes with police left 9 dead and dozens injured. Haitians angry about rising prices, high inflation, unemployment, and corruption charges against President Jovenel Moïse have demanded he step down. Protesters attacked the presidential palace and attempted to block access to the capital's airport. During the unrest, Haitian police detained 5 U.S. citizens and 2 Serbians who were carrying heavy weapons in unmarked vehicles. The Haitian government later released the group, which included military veterans and mercenaries, allowing them to return to the U.S. without charges. This fueled suspicions across Haiti that the men were part of a covert operation gone wrong. Your reporter spoke with Kim Ives, an editor with the Haiti Liberté newspaper, who talks about the current anti-government protests in Haiti that are linked with corruption charges surrounding funds embezzled or misspent from Venezuela's Petrocaribe oil discount program. Savings for the program were slated to be invested in social programs for the poor after Haiti was devastated by the 2010 earthquake.
The principal call has become for Jovenel Moïse to step down. It has really morphed into that since the protests began last summer, demanding what happened to the $4 billion of Venezuela petrodollars, which Haiti benefited from over the last decade. to step back, I guess we need to do a little historical review. These demonstrations today are very similar to what happened 33 years ago when Jean-Claude Duvalier left. He was the second of two so-called presidents for life. His father, François Papadoc Duvalier, died in 71 and passed a title and dictatorship on to his son. And basically for three decades, for 30 years, from 1957 to 86, they ruled Haiti with an iron fist. And a lot of resentment and anger grew and exploded finally in November of 1985. But Jean-Claude had to flee the country on a U.S.-supplied Air Force plane with his fast cars and his wife's minks and went to a golden exile in France. But that was really the beginning of 5 years of very tumultuous government instability, demonstrations in the street, and the result was in 1990, December 1990, the election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, an anti-imperialist liberation theology priest. The Haitians underwent a coup d'etat for that and for Aristide's re-election in 2000, a second coup d'etat, both followed by foreign military occupations by the United Nations. Nonetheless, the victory of December 16, 1990 really marked the kickoff of what was the pink tide in Latin America, because following Haiti's example, Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa, Lugo, a number of other progressive and even revolutionary presidents came to power. We could even include Lula in Brazil in that category. The Venezuelan government, as your listeners surely know, also had a coup d'etat against it in 2002, against Hugo Chavez, which the Venezuelan people turned back, also thanks in large measure to the intervention of the rank and file of the Venezuelan army. Chavez really realized that they were going to just keep coming for him and said, we have to build bridges. We have to help these other countries to come and join us in building 21st century socialism in Latin America. And so he began a program called the Petrocaribe program, whereby he would give nations cheap oil, great credit, and thereby help them in a period when oil was selling for $100 a barrel. Haiti signed on to this deal in 2006. It took them 2 years to really get everything in place because of the resistance of the U.S. Embassy and the State Department, who were fighting them behind the scenes every step of the way. And through a lot of different maneuvers, they managed to get into power a neo-Duvalierist president, a guy called Michel Martelly. Anyway, Martelly came in. And for the 5 years that he was in office, the majority of this Petrocaribe fund was plundered. And it was about $4 billion worth of petrodollars which were generated. Some of those were paid to Venezuela, but many of them went into this Petrocaribe fund. And two Senate investigations found that at least $2 million of it was embezzled, stolen, misspent, just plain lost in some cases. Jovenel Moise, who is the current president, had an agribusiness, was basically a shell company, a fake business. He was laundering millions of dollars through this agribusiness firm that came into office indicted for that money laundering. He had his agribusiness being given millions of dollars to fix a road and do other infrastructure work, none of which he did. On January 10, 2019, the Jovenel Moïse government voted to stick a knife in the back of the Venezuelans, and they voted with Washington saying that Nicolas Maduro was illegitimate. Here's a guy who came into power with only 19% of the electorate taking part in the election. And it was a very controversial election, and he's calling Nicolas Maduro, who won close to 70% of the vote in his country, even with opposition members in that vote. So the people were just said, that's it, we're going out. And hence, on February 7th, which is the anniversary of Jean-Claude's departure 33 years ago, they came out in the streets, and that began basically 10 days of what they called Haiti Lock. city was locked down. Nothing was working. Schools, stores, streets, everything was stop, 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 burning barricades everywhere. The country was in flames. The rebellion has taken what they're saying a little break. They're getting a little breath. Carnival is next week on March 5th, but it is an extremely combustible situation. And right after Carnival, or maybe when the second part of the accounting court report comes out in April, this thing is going to flare up. And maybe that may be the end. I think Jovenel is on extremely thin ice.
That was Kim Ives, an editor with the Haiti Liberté newspaper. For more news and information on the anti-government protests in Haiti, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Commuting by bicycle is growing around the country, nowhere more than in Portland, Oregon, which has the largest bike mode split of any major U.S. city. As of 2014, 7.2% of commuters were biking to work in Portland, where in most cities it's under 1%. In November, the Portland City Council approved a plan to build just under 17 miles of protected bike paths throughout the downtown area. The plan includes the step of eliminating 1,000 parking spaces and more than 13 miles of car lanes. The protected bike lanes are expected to attract even more city residents to leave their cars and hop onto bikes. The Portland Bureau of Transportation's bicycle program manager, Roger Geller, who's held that job for the past two decades, is deeply involved in transportation design, policy, and planning. At a recent event sponsored by Bike Walk Connecticut, Geller spoke about the progress his city has made, how much more can be accomplished, and the benefits of biking for the community and the environment. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the event and brings us excerpts of Geller's talk.
So we all talk about how increasing bicycling is going to benefit our communities, how it can reduce greenhouse gas emissions, about how it can improve our economies, and improve our personal and public health. We talk about how bicycling can help create equitable outcomes by reducing the household economic burden of transportation. We always talk about the potential of bicycling to accomplish these things and more. We talk about the potential because few locales in North America have realized these benefits with sufficient breadth and depth to quantitatively talk about the reality of what bicycling can deliver. So I'm here tonight to tell you that Portland, Oregon provides that measurable U.S. example of how bicycling provides these benefits. In Portland, we have measured how bicycling provides an economic benefit. We've measured how bicycling limits automobile use and provides all the benefits that come with that. And I'm here to tell you how we did that, what we accomplished, how in retrospect we've invested very little in doing that, and how we're going to be moving forward. What we've managed to do in Portland over the past 40 years, you can do it in your cities, and at a much faster pace. As an American city, Portland has always loved our automobiles. We didn't have anything resembling a bikeway network. We didn't have bicycling rates above the 1% or fewer of the strong and fearless riders. Yet we managed to change that curve, and it was largely the result of political leadership. Earl Blumenauer, now a U.S. representative from Oregon's 3rd District, was formerly a Portland city commissioner. Transportation was in his portfolio. In the 1970s and 80s, he understood the benefits of bicycling. And when, in the late 1980s, he assumed his position in city government, he worked to adopt the progressive bicycle transportation policy to make bicycling a part of daily life in Portland. In subsequent years, he was followed by Sam Adams, who was our mayor, and Steve Novick, who was a Portland commissioner. All of these political leaders understood the benefits of bicycling. They experienced it personally. They recognized that it provided benefit to the city. They all dedicated resources to developing bike infrastructure. They all provided political support for the inevitable trade-offs that come when you're trying to carve space out of the roadway for bike infrastructure. So political leadership, I've come to realize, is absolutely critical when a jurisdiction is advancing bicycle transportation. So what do you do when you have once you have political leadership? The most important thing and the thing that Portland has done is to build a bikeway network. It's rightfully a foundation of increasing bicycle use. It's the growth in miles and quality of Portland's bikeway network that's led directly to our success in increasing bike use. This is where we began 40 years ago. We had about 31 miles of bikeways. We started slowly. We had 77 miles by 1990. We didn't really pick up steam until the mid to late 1990s. And we built mostly standard bicycle lanes. Over time, as we've been learning more, we've been working to improve the quality of our bikeways, going from standard lanes to buffered lanes to protected lanes. Those improvements didn't come until much later, and we're still working on those. Most of our network is and remains conventional bike lanes. 38 years after that first slide, this is where we are today. We've got a bikeway network of about 373 miles. Political leadership being key, political leaders who want to advance bicycling, they need talking points. And this is really the first talking point I want to leave you, that more than 50% of Portland commuters live in areas where the average bicycle mode split is more than 10%. Even more interesting is this area. So you have almost 30% of Portland commuters. That's about 100,000 Portland commuters, not residents, just commuters, people who are driving to work. And the bike mode split in that area is approaching 14%. It's on a par with transit, and Portland has an excellent transit system. In the heart of Portland, about 14% bike mode split. So very good for America. It puts us on par with kind of a low-performing suburb of Amsterdam. It's really good. I don't want to belittle it. But what I hope you get from the way I'm presenting this is we're not satisfied. We're not at all satisfied. We have such great potential, as do all of our cities in the U.S., if we just invest. You get what you pay for. You get what you invest into.
That was Portland, Oregon's Bureau of Transportation Bicycle Program Manager, Roger Geller. Learn more about Portland's innovative and successful bike program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.